You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.
One of the things is we kind of keep in the back of your head as we are going through this, where we left off in our last reading. If you might recall there, the reading ended with the glory and the presence of God moving in to the tabernacle. And so here we begin Vayikra with a whole lot of detailed instructions. And one of the key things to think in the back of your head is, why? Leviticus chapter 1. Then the Lord called to Moshe and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when any man of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of animals from the herd or the flock. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer it a male without defect. He shall offer it at the doorway of the tent of meeting, that he may be accepted before the Lord. He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, that it may be accepted for him to make an atonement on his behalf. He shall slay the young bull before the Lord, and Aharon's sons, the priests, shall offer up the blood and sprinkle the blood around the altar that is at the doorway of the tent of meeting. He shall then skin the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. The sons of Aharon, the priest, shall put the fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. Then Aharon's sons, the priests, shall arrange the pieces, the head and the suet, over the wood which is on the fire that is on the altar. Its entrails, however, and its legs, he shall wash with water. And the priest shall offer up in smoke all of it on the altar for a burnt offering, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. But if his offering is from the flock, of the sheep, or of the goats, for a burnt offering, he shall offer it a male without defect. He shall slay it on the side of the altar northward before the Lord, and Aharon's sons, the priests, shall sprinkle its blood around the altar, shall then cut it into pieces with its head and its suet, and the priest shall arrange them on the wood which is on the fire that is on the altar. The entrails, however, and the legs he shall wash with water, and the priest shall offer all of it and offer it up in smoke on the altar. It is a burnt offering, an offering by fire of the soothing aroma to the Lord. But if his offering to the Lord is a burnt offering of birds, then he shall bring his offering from the turtle doves or from the young pigeons. The priest shall offer it on the priest shall bring it to the altar and wring off its head and offer it up in smoke on the altar, and its blood is to be drained out on the side of the altar. He shall also take away its crop with its feathers and cast it aside to the altar eastward, to the place of the ashes. Then he shall tear it by its wings, but he shall not sever it, and the priest shall offer it up in smoke on the altar, on the wood which is on the fire. It is a burnt offering, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. Chapter 2. Now when anyone presents a grain offering as an offering to the Lord, his offering shall be of fine flour, and he shall pour oil on it and put frankincense on it. He shall then bring it to Aharon's sons the priests, and shall take from it his handful of its fine flour and of its oil with all its frankincense. And the priest shall offer it up in smoke as a memorial portion on the altar, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. The remainder of the grain offering belongs to Aharon and his sons, a thing most holy of the offerings to the Lord by fire. Now when you bring an offering of a grain offering baked in an oven, it shall be unleavened cakes of fine flour mixed with oil, and or unleavened wafers spread with oil. If your offering is A grain offering made on the griddle, it shall be a fine flour, unleavened, mixed with oil. You shall break it into bits and pour oil on it. It is a grain offering. Now if your offering is a grain offering made in a pan, it shall be made of fine flour with oil. When you bring in the grain offering which is made of these things to the Lord, it shall be presented to the priest, and he shall bring it to the altar. The priest shall then take up from the grain offering its memorial portion, and he shall offer it up in smoke on the altar as an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. The remainder of the grain offering belongs to Aharon and his sons, a thing most holy of the offerings to the Lord by fire. No grain offering which you bring to the Lord shall be made with leaven, for you shall not offer up in smoke any leaven or any honey as an offering by fire to the Lord. As an offering of first fruits, you shall bring them to the Lord, but they shall not ascend for a soothing aroma on the altar. Every grain offering of yours, moreover, you shall season with salt, so that the salt of the covenant of your God shall not be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings you offer salt. Also, if you bring a grain offering of early ripened things to the Lord, you shall bring fresh heads of grain roasted in the fire, grits of new growth, for the grain offering of your early ripened things. You shall then put oil on it and lay incense on it. It is a grain offering. The priest shall offer up in smoke its memorial portion, part of its grits and its oil with all its incense as an offering by fire to the Lord. Chapter 3. Now if his offering is a sacrifice of peace offerings, if he is going to offer it out of the herd, whether male or female, he shall offer it without defect before the Lord. He shall lay his hand on the head of his offering and slay it at the doorway of the tent of meeting. And Aharon's sons, the priests, shall sprinkle the blood around the altar. From the sacrifice of the peace offerings, he shall present an offering by fire to the Lord, the fat that covers the entrails and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them, which is on the loins, and the lobe of the liver, which he shall remove with the kidneys. Then Aharon's sons shall offer it up in smoke on the altar, on the burnt offering, which is on the wood that is on the fire. It is an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. But if his offering for his sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord is from the flock, he shall offer it, male or female, without defect. If he is going to offer a lamb for his offering, then he shall offer it before the Lord. And he shall lay his hand on the head of his offering and slay it before the tent of meeting. And Aharon's son shall sprinkle its blood around the altar. From the sacrifice of peace offerings he shall bring as an offering by fire to the Lord its fat, the entire fat tail, which he shall remove close to the backbone, and the fat that covers the entrails and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them, which is on the loins, and the lobe of the liver, which he shall remove with the kidneys. Then the priest shall offer it up in smoke on the altar as food, an offering by fire to the Lord. Moreover, if his offering is a goat, then he shall offer it before the Lord, and he shall lay his hand on its head and slay it before the tent of meeting. And the sons of Aharon shall sprinkle its blood around the altar. From it he shall present his offering as an offering by fire to the Lord, the fat that covers the entrails and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them, which is on the loins, and the lobe of the liver, which he shall remove with the kidneys. The priest shall offer them up in smoke on the altar as food, an offering by fire for a soothing aroma. All fat is the Lord's. It is a perpetual statute throughout your generations and all your dwellings. You shall not eat fat or any blood. Chapter 4. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, If a person sins unintentionally in any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, and commits any of them, if the anointed priest sins so as to bring guilt on the people, then let him offer to the Lord a bull without defect as a sin offering for the sin he has committed. He shall bring the bull to the doorway of the tent of meeting before the Lord, and he shall lay his hand on the head of the bull and slay the bull before the Lord. Then the anointed priest is to take some of the blood of the bull and bring it to the tent of meeting. And the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle some of the blood seven times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary. The priest shall also put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense, which is before the Lord in the tent of meeting. And all the blood of the bull he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering, which is at the doorway of the tent of meeting. He shall remove from it all the fat of the bull of the sin offering, the fat that covers the entrails, and all the fat which is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them, which is on the loins, and the lobe of the liver, which he shall remove with the kidneys, just as it is removed from the ox of the sacrifice of the peace offerings. And the priest is to offer them up in smoke on the altar of burnt offering. But the hide of the bull with all its flesh, with its head and its legs and its entrails and its refuse, that is, all the rest of the bull, he is to bring out to a clean place outside the camp where the ashes are poured out, and burn it on wood with fire. Where the ashes are poured out of it, it shall be burned. Now, if the whole congregation of Israel commits an error and the matter escapes the notice of the assembly, and they commit any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, and they become guilty, when the sin which they have committed becomes known, then the assembly shall offer a bull of the herd for a sin offering and bring it before the tent of meeting. Then the elders of the congregation shall lay their hands on the head of the bull before the Lord, and the bull shall be slain before the Lord. Then the anointed priest is to bring some of the blood of the bull to the tent of meeting, and the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle it seven times before the Lord in front of the veil. He shall then put some of the blood on the horns of the altar, which is before the Lord in the tent of meeting, and all the blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering, which is at the doorway of the tent of meeting. He shall remove all its fat from it and offer it up in smoke on the altar. He shall also do with the bull just as he did with the bull of the sin offering. Thus he shall do with it. So the priest shall make atonement for them, and they will be forgiven. Then he is to bring out the bull to a place outside the camp and burn it, as he burned the first bull. It is the sin offering for the assembly. When a leader sins and unintentionally does any of the things which the Lord, his God, has commanded him not to be done, and he becomes guilty, if his sin, which he has committed, is made known to him, he shall bring for his offering a goat, a male without defect. He shall lay his head on the head of the male goat, and slay it in the place where they slay the burnt offering before the Lord. It is the sin offering. And the priest is to take some of the blood of the sin offering with his finger and put it on the horns of the altar of the burnt offering. And the rest of its blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering. All its fat he shall offer up in smoke in the altar in the case of the fat of the sacrifice of peace offerings. Thus the priest shall make atonement for him in regard to his sin, and he will be forgiven. Now, if any one of the common people sins unintentionally in doing any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done and becomes guilty, and if a sin which he has committed is made known to him, then he shall bring for his offering a goat, a female without defect, for his sin which he has committed. Then he shall lay his hand on the head of the sin offering and lay the sin offering at the place for the burnt offering. The priest shall take some of its blood with his finger and put it on the horns of the altar of burnt offering, and all the rest of its blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar. Then he shall remove all its fat, just as the fat was removed from the sacrifice of the peace offerings. And the priest shall offer it up in smoke on the altar for a soothing aroma to the Lord. Thus the priest shall make atonement for him, and he will be forgiven. But if he brings a lamb as his offering for a sin offering, he shall bring it, a female without defect. He shall lay his hand on the head of the sin offering and slay it for a sin offering in the place where they slay the burnt offering. The priest is to take some of the blood of the sin offering with his finger and put it on the horns of the altar of burnt offering, and all the rest of its blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar. Then he shall remove all its fat, just as the fat of the lamb is removed for the sacrifice of the peace offerings. And the priest shall offer them in smoke on the altar, on the offerings by fire to the Lord. Thus the priest shall make atonement for him in regard to his sin which he has committed, and he will be forgiven. Chapter 5. Now if a person sins after he hears a public adjuration to testify, when he is a witness, whether he has seen or otherwise known, if he does not tell it, then he will bear his guilt. Or if a person touches any unclean thing, whether a carcass of an unclean beast, or the carcass of unclean cattle, or carcass of unclean swarming things, though it is hidden from him and he is unclean, then he will become guilty. If he touches human uncleanness, of whatever sort his uncleanness may be with which he becomes unclean, and it is hidden from him, then he comes to know it, he will be guilty. Or if a person swears thoughtlessly with his lips to do evil or to do good, in whatever matter a man may speak thoughtlessly with an oath, and it is hidden from him, and then he comes to know it, he will be guilty in one of these. So it shall be when he becomes guilty in one of these, that he shall confess that in which he has sinned. He shall also bring his guilt offering to the Lord for his sin, which he has committed, a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat, as a sin offering. So the priest shall make atonement on his behalf for his sin. But if he cannot afford a lamb, then he shall bring to the Lord his guilt offering for that which he has sinned, two turtle doves or two young pigeons, for a sin offering, and the other for a burnt offering. He shall bring them to the priest, who shall offer first that which is for the sin offering, and he shall dip his head at the front of its neck, but he shall not sever it. Shall also sprinkle some of the blood of the sin offering on the side of the altar, while the rest of the blood should be drained out at the base of the altar. It is a sin offering. The second he shall then prepare for a burnt offering according to the ordinance. So the priest shall make atonement on his behalf for his sin which he has committed, and it will be forgiven him. But if his means are insufficient for two turtle doves or two young pigeons, then his offering for that which he has sinned, he shall bring the tenth of an ephah, a fine flour, for a sin offering. He shall not put oil on it or place incense on it, for it is a sin offering. He shall then bring it to the priest, and the priest shall take his handful of it as a memorial portion and offer it up in smoke on the altar with the offerings of the Lord by fire. It is a sin offering. So the priest shall make atonement for him concerning his sin, which he has committed from one of these, and it will be forgiven him. And the rest shall become the priests, like the grain offering. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, if a person acts unfaithfully and sins unintentionally against the Lord's holy things, then he shall bring his guilt offering to the Lord, a ram without defect from the flock, according to your valuation in silver by shekels, in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary, for a guilt offering. He shall make restitution for that which he has sinned against the holy thing, and shall add to it a fifth part and give it to the priest. The priest shall then make atonement for him with the ram of the guilt offering, and it will be forgiven him. Now, if a person sins and does any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, though he is unaware, still he is guilty and shall bear his punishment. He is then to bring to the priest a ram without defect from the flock, according to your valuation, for a guilt offering. So the priest shall make atonement for him concerning his error, in which he sinned unintentionally and did not know it, and it will be forgiven him. It is a guilt offering. He was certainly guilty before the Lord. Chapter 6. Now when the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, when a person sins and acts unfaithfully against the Lord and deceives his companion in regard to a deposit or a security entrusted to him, or through robbery, or if he has extorted from his companion, or has found what was lost and lied about it and sworn falsely, so that he sins in regarding to any one of the things a man may do, then it shall be, when he sins and becomes guilty, that he shall restore what he took by robbery and what he got by extortion, or the deposit which was entrusted to him, or the lost thing which he found, or anything about which he swore falsely. He shall make restitution for it in full and add to it 1/5 more. He shall give it to the one to whom it belongs on the day he presents his guilt offering. Then he shall bring to the priest his guilt offering to the Lord, a ram without defect from the flock, according to your valuation, for a guilt offering. And the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord, and it will be forgiven for any one of the things which he may have done to incur guilt. Okay, that is the section we're taking a look at today. Any observations before we get going too much further?
I'm a male Israelite. I am outside of the gate that separates the outside from the court. When do I go in to offer the oxen or the bull? If this is a voluntary repentance on my part, when do I go in? Are there certain days or any time I want to?
Well, one of the key things you might have seen is when he becomes aware of his guilt.
Okay. All right.
And you find out later that it's a lot to do with, you could say, adjudication.
All right. Next question. The priest is the intermediary. I give the priest my sheep, my goat, my bull, whatever. The priest is very obedient to God's instructions about what to do. I'm standing there. Where do I go? What do I do? Watch. Watch what the priest is going to do. Do I excuse myself? Do I leave?
Yeah, it talks about at the entry point. Now that I don't know as far as how much further, but you don't go much further in beyond the entry of the tent of meeting.
Right. Right. And then the priest takes over.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was wondering about some detail. Okay.
The various sacrifices for, I guess, the repentance, the thing that caught my attention, obviously the difference, there are times he's very specific about when it's a male, very specific when it's male or female, and then when he talks about the bird, there's no specific reference to male or female. And then about pouring out the blood for the bulls and the lambs, they're poured out, but for the birds, it's poured out on the side. So why that? And then I don't know, there was so much, but those are the big things that caught my eye. And then I guess, too, I'm the person that sinned or the man that sinned, so they actually kill the animal and then present it to the priest already dead?
And certain ones, yeah.
Okay.
I would like to know how this applies to us today. How does this work for us today? And the fat and all the way that they're washing everything in this detail to washing the inner parts and doing all these things. Of course, I feel suspicious because I'm like a detective, but I think that these aren't just put in here for no reason. We're reading them all the time. The process of is that speaking to us in a deeper sense. I'd like to know if that's what you think, but, and then the fat and the entrails and all that, and the difference between the females and the male, and that once you're aware of your sin, I mean, but then I know I sin willfully if I know I'm not supposed to do something, and I maybe have a vulgar word or whatever, and I know we're not supposed to do that. Is that, does that mean that there's no more offering for me?
Okay, well, two questions there. The simple one on the first one, it might sound simple, but not simple at all. And you're asking, well, how does it apply to you today? Everything here applies to you. Everything here doesn't apply to you. And we're going to get to that. Both of those seemingly paradoxical things today. And I'll say that everything applies to you as it did apply to them at that time this was written. And everything doesn't apply to you just as it didn't apply to you at the time it was written. And on to the second point, you're asking about, I'm trying to remember, what was the...
Mm-hmm.
That's a part of why it applies to you. So that's involved with how it applies to you. You asked, how does it apply to you today? It applies to you today, same as it did at that particular time.
She also mentioned about...
Oh. Oh, yes, the intentional?
Is there a sacrifice?
The good news is, in part of what we've written so far of the five different categories, you're toast. Sorry. But the good news is we haven't gotten to Leviticus 16 yet, which is where the good news is. Because otherwise, the whole rest of Leviticus, you're toast. Good news, right? But the good news is that with Leviticus 16, you're not toast. Not a loophole. There is no loophole. There's no back door. There's no, you know, pole vaulting over the wall. Nothing. No, that's what Leviticus 16 is about.
Okay.
So we're going to hint at it a little bit, but as we lead up to it, one of the key lessons is there ain't no other way around it. You're toast, except for Leviticus 16. So
my question is that the size of the offerings, the flower, the bird, the goat, the lamb, etc. Is that the size of what they can afford to bring, or is that the size of their sin?
Well, what it talks about was the size of the what you're able to afford, because it mentions on some of those things that if you're not able to afford this, then it's got some graduated ones as it goes down for either birds or in one case,
so you
know, if you bring a grain.
How much money you have.
Yeah, so that's in, for that particular category. It was a.
It somewhere in there, a quite clear sentence, do not eat fat.
Oh, yes, the fat or the blood.
Is that still for us? Still,
well,
still now?
Well, it goes to the point of what the whole point of all this is about.
So, this is a comment.
Yeah.
You know, we have to remember where they came from. They came from a culture that had all kinds of gods, the stone and wood. They weren't living gods. This is the first time in the history of the world that there's been a living God interacting with people. So prior to this, how did you know what your sin was and what would be enough to give to your idol, your God? Here now is, it's something new. You know, that's the first time in the world people are being told, this is sin. And if it's intentional, it's this. If it's unintentional, it's this. And here's the remedy for the sin. They've never been told that before. They didn't have the parameters on what was enough to offer the God.
Okay, thank you.
So last week we talked briefly about Numbers, you and I, and we made the mention of 8. And I think you said that meant completion, is that correct?
Overabundance.
Okay.
7 is completion.
Okay. So anyways, while we were reading this, I took the time to mark down every time a soothing aroma was mentioned, and that happened to be 8.
Mm-hmm.
And every time it mentioned that the sins would be forgiven, that number was also 8. I
just
thought that was kind of amazing.
Amazing, just completely random, right?
Has to be.
Completely random. Any other, Okay. Another thought?
God is teaching us obedience. That's it.
Okay. God's teaching us obedience.
I'm still hung up about that. I mean, is it all right to drink milk? I mean, or don't eat ice cream? Or, yeah, well,
one of the things we're talking about here is, where does the fat go? That's a good question. And where does the fat come from? Is this just like, you happen to go to a store?
From the milk?
Just any blood, any whatever?
Huh? What?
Any blood, any fat? One of the things, was this just like a random thing just mentioned in there? We're in the midst of talking about, pouring the blood, sprinkling the blood, dropping the blood, taking the blood here, taking the blood there, pouring it out here, pouring it out there, taking the fat out, washing it and burning it and this and that. Then there's just this thing that says, don't eat fat or blood. What do you think that would be referring to? Yes, exactly. It's not just dropped out of outer space here. This comment about blood and fat relates to the whole general thing is about the offering. Remember some of what Daniel was talking about, the barbecue? The barbecue offering where there's partaking of some of it. Apart, we're going to get to a bit of that, but actually the little bit of the fat kind of gets to the number 8, actually. Number 7 and number 8. But one of the reasons why you end up with blood and fat relates to the offerings here involved. So you might also wonder, in our previous study, we were looking at incense and anointing oil. And what did it say about it gives kind of ingredients that go in there and kind of equal portions of those. What did it say about those? Don't make anything like it. Don't burn any of the incense. Don't make something like it. Why not?
I can't remember that, but I have a question on the oil.
Yeah.
Are we allowed to use it for like fasting or something like that? But because it says like only use it for like certain things. Like,
for that specific oil, it doesn't go outside of the tabernacle.
Okay.
Or the temple.
But there's other oils for fasting and all that? Or?
Well, it talks about anointing and such like that.
Yeah.
But it's not talking about the stuff that's inside of the tabernacle, because it specifically says do not make that. And
okay.
Why? Because remember that whole thing about, do not make graven images? Well, it fits under that particular category. These are things that are specifically related to and should make you only think of certain things. It should only make you think of the intermediary things that happen there inside the tabernacle. So, those particular incenses, when you smell that, you should only think of what? Tabernacle. You should only think of presence of God. Those particular anointing oils and that particular combination of them, what should you only think of? Priesthood. You should only think of the stuff that also was inside the tabernacle. So it's not like when you're, outside and, you smell a particular fragrance and you might, oh, I recognize it. Somebody I knew back in high school or whatever used to wear the same exact thing. Well, that's the point. Why you're not supposed to take these things and use them wherever you want to. Because when you smell these things, when you see these things, they should only make you think of a certain thing in a certain place, in a certain function, and also applies to the whole blood and the fat thing. Because when you're thinking about the stuff that comes off of the altar, looks like a lot of instructions about running a slaughterhouse and a barbecue restaurant that we just went through. However, the products that come out of that involves blood and fat. So when you're talking about the things that come off of that, you should also remember where it is and what those particular functions are of the fat and the blood. Yes?
Gee, it would seem like Christianity today has intermingled Ishtar and Passover, Xmas and the birth of Christ, and they've kind of gotten those all intermingled and mixed the holy with the unholy. That's the way I kind of see what you're trying to say. Is that right?
Well, it's the one things that should be in a particular setting, in a particular context to make you think of a certain thing. So, you know, for example, those things related to, like, when it says that you should only be sacrificing in a given place, not just anywhere where you want to, not in your backyard, not anywhere where you want to do it. Once God specifically set a place, you don't do it anywhere else.
Go to Shiloh.
Yeah.
I was just thinking kind of the bigger picture now. It's a kind of these things are for us now as part, kind of like our sanctification process. So these things are set apart in their holiness as we are to be set apart and to walk in holiness. I don't know. That just, to me, it's just showing a picture of how our sanctification is working now after, you know, after Christ.
Actually, it goes back to what I said before. Everything here applies to you today, and everything here does not apply to you today. Meaning that, you know, there's a common perception that there's, you know, BC and AD related to the stuff here in this book. No, it has always been this way, and these things here were always in a certain way. When it talks about, and you will be forgiven, was it because that you just happened to, you know, pull the right handle there at the God slot machine here in the tabernacle and out came your blessings? Did it just happen to work that way at that particular time? Or has it always worked a certain way, always, right from the very beginning, all the way down through, past the cross, continuing on and forward into it? And that goes into a lot of what we'll be taking a look at in some of what Paul wrote in a big section of Hebrews as well.
They used to make lamp oil and very expensive colognes out of whale blubber.
There's a lot of blubber in a whale.
I don't know how it smelled or anything, but I know they used to do it like that.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily the Israelites, but you know, in England and other places.
Yeah, you know, fat has been used as an energy source. probably there's a lot of people who probably wish that you could use fat as an energy source in a lot more contexts. But,
one of the things I think we're talking about here is that he's talking about the specific fat is in a specific place on the sacrifices, because he also talks about oil, and oil and fat are the same thing. Oil is just kind of liquid fat, so. You know, they could use that in their cooking. And I don't know if it means that they can't use the fat. Well, I'm vegetarian anyway, but they can't use the fat of other things while they're cooking. But that, I think what he's talking about here is a specific piece of fat in the offering. Then he said, of course, a blanket statement, but, we're worried about whether or not we can drink milk and stuff like that. I don't think it has anything to do with it.
Yeah, because one of the things is where you, there's another, we'll be getting to it in a little bit, a few weeks, or talking about cooking or boiling a kid, young goat, in its mother's milk. And there's been lots of traditions that have proceeded out of that. But one of the things also is you look at the context of when that is referred to, and it refers directly to the context in which it's in, same as this prescription here about blood and fat. And to the point there, when you talk about blood seven times, talking about, well, that should be an indication. Blood, the shedding of blood, brings completion. That the matter of the sin, that the matter that the guilt was involved there, that has been totally taken care of. And then you're looking at number eight, and kind of a conversation that we get into around the time of the eighth day after the 7 days of Sukkot or Tabernacles, is the number eight comes from a Hebrew verb called shaman, and the word eight in Hebrew is shemeni, or that's eighth, and that comes from the Hebrew term shaman. And shaman refers to, I guess, no better way to say it, to be fat. To be, you know, I guess, fat and lethargic. Because that particular word of noun forms of it are also heard of, you know, you might hear in some literal translations where they talk about his ears are fat. Some translations might take a different, try to make it into a more understandable language. You know, maybe he's lazy or he doesn't doesn't understand, can't hear. But literally the term is his ears are, one translation you'll hear is his ears are dull. Literally it says his ears are fat. And one of those things that means in that is that it's just not able to hear. Not able to hear and respond. Because one of the things that we talk about with the verb to shema is that you hear and then you do. It's not just, you know, information flooding in and then it just goes into your vast resources in your head and never happens to do anything to your behavior. Shema is to hear and to respond. You know, what good is the Shema, you know, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you're like, yep, okay, got that. And just go on with whatever else you're doing. With the idea of the fatness, the insides of where we're at, that is, you could say, a source of the source of plenty, the source of your feeling that you've been filled up. In a lot of cultures, they see the idea of fatness as being blessed, which is why you'll see various representations of important figures in other cultures. He's represented as fat, very, 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 very fat, to the point where he can't move. And that is seen as a sign of blessing, of opulence, of a idea of you have everything you need and even more so. Well, one of the ideas of fat and why 8 is seen as the new beginning where it's gone to the top and is now flowing over. That is the idea of 8. That is the idea of Shaman, is that it's filled up and is flowing over. So that's why you have the 7 days of Sukkot, of Tabernacles, and then the 8th day after that. It's, you've filled this now up. You've had the dwelling place of God, and then is now gone into a new phase. Some people in ancient times took this a bit too far in their interpretation of it, as they said in some of the centuries AD, they will say, well, one of the teachings we have of the 8th day is that you have now come to the completion of things, which was what the 7th day, what the Shabbat is all about. And then now the 8th day says something new has begun. So thus, you'll then see part of the shift where things and the greater body of Messiah has shifted away from the 7th day Shabbat as being something that is a memorial of rest and the great sign of the things that we talked about of God is the Creator, God is the Redeemer, God is the Savior, God is the Healer, God is the Sanctifier. To now another view of it is, okay, now we've entered the new phase going forward. So that's something you see in some of the early writings in the first few centuries AD. But getting back to the point of the fat is one of the things that you will see in Psalm 51. We'll be getting in that general vicinity today. But in Psalm 51, it says that, I seek truth where? Yeah, you seek truth in the inward parts, in your guts. You seek truth in your inner parts, in your guts. And it's should be no shocking surprise that the latter part of Psalm 51 talks about, you know, you did not desire the blood of bull and goats, or I would have brought it. What you desire is a contrite heart. Huh. I thought this was all about, you know, pulling the handle there at the tabernacle and out come God's blessings. You mean to tell me that all this stuff about the blood of bulls and goats was all about contrite heart, even at David's time? Well, yeah, it was even at the time of Moses too, which we'll be getting to here shortly. So any other last thoughts before we move into this further? Yes?
Surrounding the bronze altar was blood-soaked.
Blood-soaked.
Oy.
So I guess it was probably a good idea with the idea of moving around from time to time. They're like, okay, time to go.
Solomon's temple.
Yeah, and Solomon was in charge with cleaning that floor.
Oh, every day?
Yep. Someone had to clean the floor, which is, I guess, a pretty good metaphor. In God's house, when, you know, the blood is spilled and such, someone has to clean up the mess, which is quite interesting because you get the picture of the God bringing the one who covers over it with the blood spilled and God also being the one who directs the cleaning up part. Yes, we have a question or comment down here.
I think what he wants us to be aware of is if we sin, something has to die. And we're just lucky that he set up a system that it's not us that dies.
Yeah.
But something has to die.
Yeah. So just a little bit of a recap as we go into this. The section that we're looking at today is called Vayikra, which means "and he called," and gets the term of, you know, the Hebrew term that is referred to with Leviticus. And he called. And it starts out that part of, and he called from where? Well, yeah, we've got these nice little division parts of the books, you know, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. But you should more think of this as like a flowing thought from one to the next. And with Exodus, it ends with the tabernacle being occupied. The one for whom the tabernacle is there, he moves in. It's been dedicated, the priesthood, everybody is dedicated, everything's ready to go, and God moves in. But then everybody else has to get out. So you could be like these folk who have the tabernacle there in the midst of all the camps, and everybody's outside. Even the priesthood is outside. It's like, okay, great. Now what? You have a tabernacle that's been built there, but then what do you do about it? How do you get in? And that's really what the whole book is about. What all of Leviticus is about is God moves in, everybody's excluded, then how do you get back in again? Because remember, as we talked about, that this is pretty specifically about the dwelling place of God among the people of God. Well, is that great? Just kind of drops it there in the middle, and everybody's supposed to say, oh, that's curious, but does he actually want us in his presence or not? Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but something, and I'm sure we've talked about this before, something that came up the other night, and it's just been kind of wandering around in my brain. But when we get to when they're wandering in the desert, and for 40 years, or I don't know the time period, but there's a time when manna is falling from the sky. However, they have sheep and goats and cows and bulls with them, and they're crying that they can't eat meat. I don't understand what's going on here. How do you have all these animals, and yet you're not eating meat? I mean, what's going on there? I just don't get that.
It's never enough. I guess you could say that that would be a way that that's described. Why then do you think that that's the prescription as you get into Deuteronomy near the beginning, is that, you know, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. The manna came every day. They got sick of that. They had food. They got sick of that. The point was, are you actually trusting and wanting to cling to what God says, or are you looking for something else? And in each of those cases where they were crying out for this, crying out for that, they were looking for something else. Like, you know, back in Exodus 17, where they were crying out for water. Crying out for water. They've just been through the Red Sea. It's like, wow, God can do that. Is he going to just let them die? Not have any water? Yes.
Okay, another thought. I'm looking at that picture up there. All those little dots, those are tents.
Yeah.
6 million people.
Pretty intense.
Not counting women and children.
600,000, yes.
Oh, 600,000?
Yeah, that's enough anyway.
Same difference.
Yeah.
Yeah, and animals.
Yeah.
Oy vey.
Oy vey, yes. That's a good way to put it. Well, when we go on further beyond this, let's see, is this going to wake up? Wake up. Hello. There we go. So just a little bit of a reminder as we go back into the tent and kind of take a look at it. The tent that we have is, we had the perimeter. We had talked about the perimeter keeping everyone out because this is a holy place. This is a set aside place. For what purpose? Well, the point here in this tent, here, the presence of God dwelling there. The presence of God dwelling here, and stuff happening in here is all about the presence of God being in there and having any sort of relation between all the people around the camp, around this tabernacle, and approaching God at all. So when we break it down, we have these various items kind of moving in from the entrance. Now, it's good to remember our orientation here, that the entrance here is on the east side. So if you were, as Daniel was talking about with the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Testimony, and the mercy seat being like the throne, and you get the figure of the Lord sitting on his throne, which direction is he looking?
West.
East. He's looking east. Which, when you get into the prophets, one of the big travesties comes is because the priesthood are there at the entrance of the temple looking where? Looking to the rising sun. So, which direction does the sun come up? East. You know, it rises in the east and sets in the west. Rises in the east and sets in the west. So, if the Lord is looking east and the priesthood is looking east, who are the priesthood looking at? The big ball of fire in the sky. Not the one who created the big ball of fire in the sky. They have their backs to the Creator. Wow. So this whole thing is, you have the, is, as is talked about, the pattern that was shown on the mountain, the throne room of God here, a little microcosm of this, with the Ark of the Covenant being the throne, and approaching the throne. Approaching into the throne is what this thing is all about with the tabernacle. So whether it is you have the veil, the separating part, as we get to in Leviticus 16. Oh yeah, that part about the yeah, but on the intentional sins. Don't ever approach, except on the part where you need to cover over all of the sins. Not only the sins, the unintentional things, but also the transgressions. Beginning to more of these three various things, the sins, transgressions, and iniquities. They're not just synonyms for the same thing. They're, you could say, graduate degrees of increasing, how do you say it? Increasing insolence or rebellion against God from the sins of missing the mark or oops to transgressions of like more willful, but still not an outright rebellion to the iniquities of like, wow, that's like what we call treason today. Iniquities, you can might think of that as treasonous. So, of all these things, the stuff of the intentional sins, the intentional, the transgression, the iniquities, the stuff that's intentionally done, there's only one way that that's taken care of. And that's part of what is referred to in Leviticus 16. So, from long ago, a tradition has come out that children are taught very much as soon as they can start comprehending things at very, very young age. They start with Vayikra. They start with Leviticus. Now, if you ever tried those through the Bible reading plans, you do like the beginning part of Genesis and continuing on through. I know personally for my case that several attempts ended in Leviticus. They barely made it through the end of Exodus. Oh, maybe I can hold on. And then Leviticus, oh, good grief. So, one of the things that's often approached is wow, you get to Leviticus, I'm glad that we don't have to do any of this stuff anymore. Not only is it gross, gory, disgusting. I mean, look at all the stuff we were talking about with entrails and chopping this up and ripping it apart. It is just gory, nasty stuff. Plus, you know, you've got this impression that it's like a, I do this for you, you do this for me. I bring in this goat, and then you give me the atonement. And it's like a transaction. You go in there and you pay the fine, and whoop, it's all done and free. But a lot of what we get at with, as we saw in Exodus and as we cruise into Vayikra, is that this part here is just like what Moshe saw on the mountain. It is a pattern. It is a shadow of the realities that are going on. Always has been. Always. From the moment that Moshe saw those things on the mountain, from the moment that the people were painting their doorposts there in Mitzrayim, it was always a pattern. Always a shadow. Because was that lamb's blood on the doorposts there on the Pesach night? Could that stop the creator of heaven and earth? What do you think? This is like a talisman? You kind of slap some piece of paper up on the door and it's like a magical force field and it keeps out the creator of heaven and earth? Nothing. It did nothing in and of itself. Except of what? The trust that you had that the one who was bringing this all about and who promised that you're going to take him out, and if you held on to that promise of whatever degree, back going back to Abraham, even going back to Adam, if you happen to recall the accounts that have been passed down from one person to the next, all of that was about trusting in the one who said these things. And you see, a lot of the Bible is honest reflections about people and their levels of trust. Reflects kind of like on our levels of trust today, because I know that I can go and kind of like a roller coaster of levels of trust to the point of, you know, wanting to charge right on into a furnace or a lion's den to, wow, couldn't you just pick somebody else for this? Just pass us by? Why do you have to pick us? Pick me for this? But one of the things that we see in this calling is it's a calling to come in. The beginning part, he called out. He called out from where? From here. The presence of God is there in the most holy place, there with the Ark of the Testimony, calling out to Moshe, okay, this is how we now move forward. So the moving forward part into the courtyard, and a lot of what we were talking about today involves what happens in the courtyard, whether it's, you know, as the people come through the gate, they're coming in from the east, and it talks about laying their hands upon their offering, their gift, and then offered at the altar. For some of the offerings, it was poured out on the north side of it, and then some of it was out to the east of where the ashes were poured out, and then some of that was talked about with the other offerings that were sprinkled toward, the seven times toward, the presence of God. And we talked about the seven. So you had the shedding of blood, and then with the realization, with this, you'd say, elevating your level of guilt up higher, that had been taken care of, that had reached a completion. Because it says, and he was forgiven. Was it forgiven just because you managed to sprinkle the stuff? You know, you did it six times. Oh, not enough. Seven times. Okay, cha-ching, and out comes the forgiveness. No. Didn't work then, doesn't work now, never did. Never did work that way. One of the things that we see of the word that we have translated as offering or gift is, let's see if we have it here, is the Hebrew term for this is korban. And I see it spelled with a K, a Q depends on how you want to transliterate it. Some people like to transliterate the cough today with a Q instead of a K, but it's the same kind of sound. It's a K sound. But korban, you might remember reading from the Gospels of korban. Well, that's what it's referring to. It's referring to this, these offerings. Well, the thing of korban is it is referring to approaching, to come near, to draw near, to be brought near, to cause to approach, to present. Those are all varying shades of meanings of korban, the verb that it comes from. So what we're really talking about is something is coming near. The carcass, the smoke, the blood, the fat, the burned up grain, flour, cakes. I mean, throwing all kinds of stuff there on the altar and dripping it here and dripping it there. What is coming near? The person who brought it in the door. That's what the drawing near is here. That is who is coming near. Now, you remember, as we go back out here and look at this, for the common people who were not of the sons of Aharon, specifically set aside, sanctified, this is your job here. You fill a role. You are there between the presence of God there on the Ark of the Testimony and the front door is the priesthood. The common people, this is where they stop. They stop there at the door. But what goes forward? The korbanot. The korbanot go forward. The offering goes forward. That which comes near, that which is brought near, goes forward beyond that. Because why? The presence of God is not something that could be easily approached. He specifically does that, you know, you could say from his raw presence, his raw power. He says, no one can see me, you know, full on and live. But also to emphasize that, hey, this outside part here, even if you're in the, quote, community of God, unquote, you're still, you could say, in a level of detox from the world. The stuff that's got us hooked on the way things go apart from God, this is all about a level of detox going in. So one of the things that we have about the gifts and the sacrifices and how they themselves cannot clear the conscience. Just a few examples of this in Psalm 50. Psalm 50 verses 11 through 15. I know every bird of the mountains and everything that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all it contains. Shall I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of male goats? Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and pay your vows to the Most High. Call upon me in the day of trouble and I shall rescue you and you will honor me. So, again, go up to the celestial slot machine there at the tabernacle and pull the handle and out come the blessings, right? Does the Lord need all the stuff that's coming in through the front door? No, doesn't need any of it. But he asked for it. And that's part of what we're kind of looking at here today. Why is he asking for it? It's the same reason then as it is now, as it was in the first century. When Yeshua was here, it's always been the same thing. The same way that you come in through the front door where God's house is and then proceed all the way into the presence of God. Always been the same way that that works. Another passage here, kind of looking at, this is often quoted as being a good example. Oh, yes.
Sorry, Jeff. So, are you saying that with these sacrifices, you know, it says that they shall be forgiven, but that the sacrifice itself doesn't change their heart.
No.
So there's still a part missing, which is the heart change.
Always has been that way. Always.
But there is forgiveness.
Of course there is. And there always has been. Okay. Always has been. But in this passage, we're getting at right here, Psalm chapter 1, we'll see what a disconnect here. And, you know, the Apostle Peter talks about Paul, and some of the things that he wrote are difficult to understand, and that lawless people will twist them to their own destruction. Well, some people have taken here these prophets' very, very strong, you know, revelation from God and twisted it around. Because a lot of what it is saying here in Isaiah chapter 1 is exactly what we just saw in Psalm 50. And if you go on, Psalm 51 says something quite similar. So Isaiah chapter 1, verses 10 through 13. Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Ouch. Ooh. Give ear to the instruction of our God, you people of Gomorrah. Ow. What are your multiplied sacrifices to me, says the Lord? I have had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed cattle, and I take no pleasure in the blood of ghouls, bulls, lambs, or goats. When you come to appear before me, who requires of you this trampling of my courts? Bring your worthless offerings no longer. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Shabbat, the calling of assemblies, I cannot endure iniquity and the solemn assembly. Ouch! It says here, I cannot endure your. Last little part there, I cannot endure iniquity and the solemn assembly. So again, this is kind of a very good reminder that there is not a, you know, magic bingo card that you have here at the front door. Not the slot machine, not any sort of little secret handshake that you do to get in here. And as long as you do it in the correct way, then, you know, cha-ching, you hit the jackpot. Never been that way. Never will be that way. And it talks about in Ezekiel about the so-called third temple, as it's called there, talk about the construction of it there in the day of the Lord. Things related to that, people were like, well, why on earth would the sacrificial system ever come back? We're saved by the blood of the Lamb. Yeah, always have been, always will be. The stuff here in the tabernacle has never been about pulling God's chain. Never has been, never will be. Yes?
I've always felt that a lot of that offering of food was there to supply the Levites because they had no other inheritance. They didn't have their own fields to grow in and so forth.
That's true. That's why we saw it just in the first few chapters of our section we're looking at here, that it's like, okay, the remainder of this is for Aharon and his sons. Yeah, so a good portion of this is going to feed them. So, yeah, it's good that it was a complete diet of various types, not just, it wasn't like the total carnivorous diet, it was also all some grains and things related to that, some poultry in there. But the point of that,
the physical way.
Yes, the physical way, and the priesthood was there to take the gifts that come in and deliver them over. To what? To take the people in their symbol form as the korban. Take a person as a korban in here and take him all the way to the presence of God. Now, all the way to the presence of God, that specifically as we get to Leviticus 16, that happens at a specific time of the year, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. But eventually, everybody makes it all the way in to God's presence. Everybody makes it in through the veil, which should start getting your wheels turning as you start thinking about the book of Hebrews. But And speaking of Hebrews, that's actually where we're going next. Because one of the things that should start becoming clear, as we saw here in this passage in Isaiah, and as you read Isaiah on, you'll see these scathing rebukes about what is going on in the temple, and the things that are happening in the temple, and how the priesthood are treating the temple of God, and how they're treating this relationship with God. And as you read closely into that, you'll see, just like in Psalms, just like as you see in Deuteronomy, that the one thing to remember about all this stuff is it is about loving the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And loving your neighbor as yourself, as you would yourself. So we're going to be taking a look at a chunk here of Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 8. Hebrews, like Romans, is, you know, it was challenging to drop into, but hopefully in our look at this, I think we'll go through verse 8 of, verse 9 of chapter 10. As we look at this. Now, again, if you haven't had a chance to go all the way through Hebrews in one sitting, I know that's a lot of stuff and a lot of sometimes very detailed stuff and involved discussions. But like with Romans, if you ever read Romans, make sure that you pretty much read it in one sitting. Because if you drop into it, you can get very wrong ideas. And sometimes it looks like Paul is talking in circles. And if you drop into the midst of one of his discussions where he's arguing one side, then the other side, you can get a completely wrong idea, just like with Isaiah chapter 1. If you were to go in here and look at that and go, aha, there we go. You know, take everything from Matthew backward, chop it out of your book, because that chapter is closed and completely irrelevant. But what we will note here, as we'll see in short order, that just as Yeshua taught in parables, that is what this is. This tabernacle is one gigantic parable. The lot of the Torah is a gigantic parable. So just as with Yeshua's parables, we ignore them at our peril. So too, with this, we ignore it, skip over it at our own peril, because there are lessons here that are reflected upon all the way throughout. In fact, all of what Yeshua was doing there on the cross has to do with the parable, that the pattern that was shown to Moshe on the mountain. So, Hebrews chapter 9, starting in, let's say, verse 8. The Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place has not yet been disclosed, while the outer tabernacle, or it literally says the first tabernacle, is still standing, which is a symbol for the present time. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience, since they relate only to food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until a time of reformation. But when the Messiah appeared as a high priest for the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, and not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood, he entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling those who have been defiled sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? For this reason, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that since a death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were committed under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. For where a covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of the one who made it. For a covenant is valid only when men are dead, for it is never in force while the one who made it lives. Therefore, even the first was not inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment had been spoken by Moshe to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of the calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you." And in the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry with the blood. According to the law, one may almost say, all things are cleansed with blood, and without shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. Therefore, it was necessary for the copies of the things in the heavens to be cleansed with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Nor was it that he would offer himself often, as the high priest enters the holy place year by year, with blood that is not his own. Otherwise, he would have needed to suffer often since the foundation of the world. But now, once at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And insomuch as it was appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment, so Christ also, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time for salvation without reference to sin to those who eagerly await him. In chapter 10. For the law, since it has a shadow of the things, the good things to come, not the very form of things, can never, by the same sacrifices which they offer continually year by year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, it would not have ceased to have been offered, because the worshippers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have any conscience of sins. But in those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins year by year. For it is impossible by the blood of goats and bulls to take away sins. Therefore, when he comes into the world, he says, "Sacrifice and offering you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. And whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you have taken no pleasure." Then I said, "Behold, I have come, and the scroll it is written, and the scroll of the book it is written of me, to do your will, O God." After saying above, "Sacrifices and offerings and whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you have not desired, nor have you taken pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law." Then he said, "Behold, I have come to do your will." He has taken away the first in order to establish the second. And one of the things that you've seen there as far as the taking away the first is that the temple was taken away at last time at in AD 70. As we kind of talked about in previous sessions about the term abomination of desolation, it's happened a few times before that as well. You know, one of the times we mentioned here of Shiloh, that was one place where there was a glory. The glory had departed, or ichavot. The glory had departed. And then there was also the temples that were left desolate with the invasions by the Babylonian Empire. And then the Seleucid Empire had a number of these desolations that have come in. And for what reason? These abominations have come because, you know, just like what we had seen there in Psalms, the people had decided to go off on their own and forget what it is and the reason why the temple is there. Yeah, you had a comment? Oh, sorry. Oh, yes, we have a question back there. Sorry.
Off track about the graven images. It kind of seems like it's more pertaining to like an image stuck in your mind. I don't know. I guess that's more of a question than
engraving images.
Yeah, than proclamation. But
well, it is interesting that you point that out. It's an image stuck in your mind. Because one of,
or you know, like keeping an offense constantly in your mind, like the victimhood. Anyways.
Well, it's very interesting you mentioned that part about materialism. We'll be getting to that in just a bit later when we talk about the salt offering. But it does actually, you know, relate as what we say here about graven images. One of the things about the graven images, and it specifically talks about don't make it any likeness in heaven above or in the earth below. And when you start saying likeness, it maybe should start you thinking about Genesis chapter 1, where it talks about, then he made man. He made woman. In the likeness of God, he created them. The image of God. So image and likeness, they're together. He's saying that when you see mankind, you really should be saying, praise God. Wow, that's absolutely amazing. I know. Most of us may just naturally want to, you know, grit our teeth and shake your fist, maybe at sometimes parts of mankind. But when you, like the psalmist was saying about how we are fearfully and wonderfully made, that's just kind of reflecting upon things. You look throughout the animal world and the other creation out there, nothing like mankind. Nothing like mankind whatsoever. Ability to talk, ability to think, ability to know where we came from, to know where things are going, that's something is quite unique. So thus, mankind should be pointing us back to the Creator, where everything comes from. And that's one of the dangers that you get with the images that start to put God in a box. Notice when we talk about the box that God called for, he's not in the box. He's on the box, but not any sort of thing that's actually represented. You know, okay, yeah, the cherubim are there facing each other, but there is no representation whatsoever of the Lord there in one bit whatsoever. You'll know when he's there. It's pretty obvious when he's there. As you'll see, it talks about the smoke, the presence, the fire, but not any specific representation itself. Yes?
Sorry, a teeny bit off topic, but you saying that, just I've been really thinking a lot about this, specifically regarding the ark, when you say about God being out, he's not in. I feel like the ark is a representation of us, that yeah. We're his ark, being that, you know, thy word I hid in my heart that I might not sin against thee, you know, his commandments. Aaron's rod, his authority through the Holy Spirit, he has given us his authority. And it's just amazing. And then through the Holy Spirit too, we have his presence who dwells in us, with us, around us.
Yeah, it's actually something that Daniel went to when we were going through the construction of the tabernacle itself, talking about how when you look at the way that the ark is constructed, it really points to a person that's, you have the, just as you mentioned, the tablets of the testimony is inside. That's where it should be. And actually, as you can, like with Hebrews here, continue on, it continues on with a quotation down there in verse, starting in 16 of chapter 10, 16 on, one of the longest quotations that we have from the Tanakh or the Hebrew scriptures in the Apostolic writings is you find in Hebrews where it quotes from the New Covenant prophecy back from Jeremiah chapter 31 verses 31 through 34. And that's where you talk about the New Covenant. That's where that thing is first prophesied. And one of those things that it talks about, that New Covenant, is that he is going to take his laws and write them on our hearts. Because just what we looked at there in just a short little bit of Hebrews that we looked at in chapters 9 and 10, what was the problem? us. The problem was our conscience, not ever being cleared by external things. Because these things, this is we've been talking about a lot here today, these are external things. They are representations, we could say, shadows, patterns of things that are happening inside of us. The plan of God that's working through us to clean us up, to move us from the area, oh, we got to go through detox, all the way to the place where we are a new creation, where we can enter into the presence of God. And that's why you hit the rewind tape in Hebrews, back a few chapters into chapter 4, chapter 5, where it starts introducing this Yeshua as the great high priest, where you have the Levitical priesthood, they operate in here, but again, they, in between these abominations of desolation, they do their thing, but all they are doing, I shouldn't say all they are doing, it's kind of like saying merely what they're doing is extremely important, just as in a parable is extremely important. But if you focus on the details of the parable and miss the point of it, miss the punchline, you know, have you actually learned anything? Has the parable been of any use to you whatsoever? No. You know, you might as well have read a fairy tale because it's had about as much impact on you. So just like with Isaiah here, if you go through this whole process, even if you're one of these ones who comes from the line of Aaron, and you serve in there, and you don't pay attention to what it is that you are supposed to be doing, and are teaching the people around you what all this stuff is, and what it all means, then your service is, you could say, worthless on the good side, and detrimental on the bad side. And we've seen some mentions in the Word about some priests that have been quite detrimental to the people of God, to the point where their behavior was so reprehensible that people didn't even want to go to the house of God anymore because of the bad behavior that was going on there. Well, don't we hear a lot about that today? People say, oh, I don't want to ever be around those believers in the Messiah, you know, because I was around one and he was such a hypocrite and this and that and the other. Well, it's nothing new. People are people. People all need to go through detox. And there's always been people, you probably encounter people who are even in recovery service businesses and whatever, who end up getting arrested for stealing drugs. Well, you lose the point of what it is that you're actually doing. Are you putting on a show, or are you actually transforming? Are you performing butchery and working in a barbecue, or are you working to transform people so that they are different after this whole process?
Would that fall under the fruits of the Spirit, where some prophecy, some teach, however else the rest of that goes?
Yeah, some are given to do different things. But you notice that also the things of the Spirit, not only in the roles that you're given to do and the gifts that you're given to do those roles, but also the what comes out the other end. This whole thing in here in the tabernacle is a work of the Spirit. It is a parable of things that are happening because of the Spirit's work. That's the big point that Paul gets at in Romans chapter 8, is that the law only works if the Spirit is behind it. It's the only way that you can actually do anything close to what the law is talking about, is if you have the Spirit of God transforming you through this process. Because otherwise, it's just a butchery at best and a big waste of time at worst, or a laughingstock at the even the worst part of that. So when we look through on some of the, talked about some of the gifts that are given, these various forms of it, you have the burnt offering, and you have the korban mincha, the other one fell off there, I apologize. That's the korban olah, which is the one that goes up. It's called the burnt offering. And the term that's given of olah, olah is a Hebrew term that means that which goes up. So it's often given as the term for the burnt offering, because the burnt offering, the whole visual picture, the parable of the burnt offering is that which goes on is completely consumed. It goes up. So we have also the korban mincha, which is the grain offerings, basically, is a good way to put those. Then you have the korban shelamim. You might vaguely recognize shelamim as coming from shalom, which is why it's called the peace offering, because that which makes peace. And the korban chatat. And chatat comes from the general Hebrew term for sin, which is chet. And that's, when we talk about sins, transgressions, iniquities, the chet is the sin part. That's the general term of missing the mark. But what is the transformation that happens in this whole process? One of the things that I think is really good to look at, first off, let's see, with the burnt offering, skip down to the grain offering. Grain offering is one that would be good to take a particular look at, because you might have noticed in there in Leviticus chapter 2 when it talks about the grain offering, we'll get to it again. All these we'll get to again in really the next parasha. Here in this section, chapters 1 through 5, the beginning part of 6 in Leviticus, it's talking about from the perspective of the people, this is the things that you bring for these offerings, these items that bring you close to God's presence. And the next section will go into, okay, priests, this is what you do with it when the things come through the door. So it'll go through these offerings yet again in the next couple of chapters, in chapters 6 and 7 after this. But one of the things that was noted in here in Leviticus chapter 2 is the offering of the first fruits there in Leviticus 2 verse 12. So the offering of the first fruits, which you shall bring them to the Lord, but they are not to ascend for a soothing aroma on the altar. Huh, that's interesting. I know I was looking through that and it kind of like, well, that's kind of bizarre. Why is it that the first fruits that come in and they're not presented on the altar? Now, I can't take a look on it if I don't have any sort of great revelations on that. The first thing that popped into my head is, what is the first fruits that ascended without being consumed? Think cross, tomb, resurrection, ascension. That, and what is Yeshua referred to? He's just a few examples of this. He is referred to as the first fruits of the resurrection. Some of what we take a look at with the first fruits of it is the term that we have here first is Rashit. Rashit, you think of Rosh. Rosh is the Hebrew term for head. So Rashit is, you say, first or beginning. In the book of Genesis, the first word in that from which it gets its Hebrew name of Bereshit means, you know, in the beginning. So Rashit means that which starts the beginning of it. And kind of interesting how you have the idea of the head in which it starts. Because the first fruits, and also kind of applies to the firstborn in a number of cases, what is considered the firstborn isn't necessarily the first. It is where everything points to, which is kind of like why the coming from a head is actually a good way to put first fruits, because it may not be the first, the absolute first thing that comes out, but it is the best, the ultimate of it. Yes, we have a... So what?
Babies are born head first.
Babies are born head first, yes. Optimally, yes. It works much better that way. But one of the things that we... And it get to a little bit here and when we talk about a little bit more of what is involved with the head part. Another term for the first fruits is bikurim. You might hear people refer to the We have a little banner over here where it talks about behind you. This is Reshit, Reshit Chetzer. And the meaning of that is the beginning of the harvest, the wave sheaf of the first of the harvest. That's get to it as we move on further in Leviticus, but it's connected to Passover and the days of unleavened bread. And one of the gifts that's brought in that is the first fruit of the harvest. And it's quite interesting here in this particular passage that it refers to this particular part of what you bring being the green heads of grain roasted in fire, the new heads of grain. So that which comes out with the first fruits, that is something that's presented but doesn't go up in flames. So one of the interesting pictures that we have going forward is like, huh, look to something that which is a first fruits, which does not go up and is consumed. Because one of the things that we'll look at when you take a look at the Passover, what is the thing that the Passover, the Pesach sacrifice is known for? You eat it before morning. Make sure that it is consumed before morning. And a number of the sacrifices, it says, you don't leave it over until the third day. So the things that you are going to do with the sacrifice, make sure that it is completely gone until the third, by the third day. So thus, when you see this, you have a kind of these pictures here. You have pictures of the sacrifices, the things that cover, the things that cover, that bring atonement, that bring forgiveness, that which is going to bring forgiveness, that will be totally consumed. But then the first fruit, that will be presented without being consumed and be consumed in kind of a different way. But one of the things that we see with the in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 3, see kind of this curious mention of the head of creation, the Rosh of creation, with Messiah. And says, but I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and man is the head of a woman, and God is the head of Christ. And it goes on, and that can open up a can of worms that we're not going to hear today, but just sufficient to at least put the point into. We're talking about the head, where the focus is, where the responsibility lays on. Not saying that it's necessarily the first thing to actually come out, but it is the focal point, that which becomes, you could say, greatest and leads going forward. We see also from this that with Adam being the first of the first people, when he went astray, then there was the second Adam. So that second Adam became greater, the second Adam, even though he was not first. He became greater than the first Adam. So that second Adam became the Rosh versus the first Adam and carried that moving forward. So let's move on into one of the curious parts of this passage that we're looking at in the grain offering, and that is on the salt offering. I mean, it's kind of described as the covenant of salt, which is described in Leviticus 2, verse 13. So Leviticus 2:13 talks about when you bring an offering, you bring these offerings, make sure that you bring it with salt. So the mincha, the grain offering, comes in with salt on it. And like, well, that's, I guess, you know, if you make bread, you're making bread, it's always good to have salt in the bread. So is it just that you're having it make tasty, make sure that it's going to be tasty and not dry and bland and disgusting? Is that the point of where the salt is? Some of what we get at with salt, there's a number of descriptions throughout the word. We'll see a couple of examples that Yeshua brings up about salt. But some of the examples that we have about salt kind of gives us some options as to what salt can really point to. First of which kind of comes from Ezra chapter 4. So, you know, Ezra, this is the reconstruction after the exiles, after one of those abominations of desolation that came with the Babylonian exile. Then you have the return, you know, recorded there in Ezra and Nehemiah. And in one of those cases, it talks about in Ezra 4:14 that this particular place, they are in, and depending on your translation, this particular one, New American Standard, talks about they are in the service of the palace. Now, the interesting point of that is the literal phrase of where it talks about is they are in the salt of the palace. They are enjoying the salt of the palace. So one of the ideas that you can get from that is that salt could be a symbol of hospitality. You dwell in somebody's house, you abide by the rules, so thus you get apportioned your salt. And if you live in a hot climate and sweat a lot, you got to make sure that your salt intake is up to snuff, because that's an essential part of life. Your electrolytes go down, it can be extremely bad news. So that's one idea of a part of hospitality, you get apportioned salt. Something else is seen in the people's history of culinary pursuits is that salt is a preservative. And you know, depending on what kind of bad stuff, the bacteria and whatnot, if you get a salt saline concentration of like 20% or so, you can pretty much knock out most of the bacteria. The bacteria kind of go off first, and then the mold and yeast, the bad news ones there, will tend to die off in your food at about a 20% concentration. And the kind of interesting part about that, of what salt and actually sugar does, so you've done canning with either salt or sugar, one of the things that both of them do is they, if they're in a solution, they replace what the content is somewhere else. So if they're in the yeast or the bacteria or whatnot, they will move from the solution into the bacteria. And you know, a lot of saltiness tends to shut the systems down of microbes. So thus, you'll have a situation where the salt will come in and repopulate the other part of it. So you get this picture of salt as a preservative moving in and taking over the bad stuff. Yes?
Back in the old days.
The old days.
If they got flogged afterwards, they had salt put on their wounds.
Yeah.
To help heal up right.
And one of the things about putting salt on either wounds or in on meat or something like that, or mummies, one of the big things about making a mummy is involving different types of salt. And what happens after the process of using all that salt on a mummy? Oh, probably you've seen mummies in a museum. You know, they look like what? A giant prune. Because it draws out the moisture. Just like in a solution, the saline and or the sugar will travel from one concentration to the other. It's kind of like heat, you know, it'll move from where it's hot to where it's cold until it's equilibrium between the places. Salt and sugar tend to be like that as well. They'll move from places where there's a lot of it to places where there's not a lot of it and move in there. And kind of in a similar way with the process of osmosis or moving of water between cells and such, that salt will also draw out what's in there. And you know, like in koshering, you use kosher salt to draw blood out of meat. Because it's moving, the liquid now, moving to where it's not so much. Yes?
And you get a loaf of bread.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So one of these things that you'll see that's salt, not just a something to kind of a nice little flavor enhancer, but it's also something that works as a preservative. And and say, okay, well, where does that come in? But you'll see in Numbers chapter 18, verse 19, so Numbers chapter 18, verse 19, and 2 Chronicles 13, verse 5, 2 Chronicles 13, verse 5, they'll mention the priests are given an everlasting covenant of salt. And then also in 2 Chronicles 13, verse 5, talks about the line of David having an everlasting covenant of salt. And you're like, what? Well, if you get sort of the idea of a preservative, you'll see that the priesthood and the line of David both being preserved. And you'll see the terms about the everlasting priesthood. And, you know, your line, talking about David, they'll never cease to have a line of David on the throne until you get to the ultimate line of David in the Messiah, so that there would be that line of David on the throne. So that picture of preservation is to make it last a really, really long time to keep going is another picture of where salt is. No, more salt and you're going to kick the bucket. Yes. Yeah, so that's one of the
doctor.
Well, that's one of the things that goes on today is the discussions about the healthiness of salt. And it goes like a whipsaw with any sort of health directives and health studies. Remember, you know, salt used to be the enemy. Now it's like, is it not the enemy? And yeah. Reports back and forth as to whether it's bad. It's kind of like saturated fat, is it bad? Is it not bad? That's whipsawed back and forth. You know, get the butter out of your diet. Get the margarine into your diet. Ooh, the margarine's bad. Get the margarine out of your diet. Get the butter back in your diet. Oh. Well, one of the things that we get to also with salt is, you might have heard about it in warfare, and there's a couple mentions of it in the Bible as well, is when an army comes in, they'll destroy the place, and then it talks about also sowing the ground with salt. Instead of spreading seed, you kind of mix in salt. And if you ever try to grow anything in an area with a high brine water table, you know, good luck with that. It's pretty bad. And there's large sections of the southern part of Sonoma County and the Carneros area has some intrusion of salt water from the bay, and that's wreaked havoc with people trying to grow grapevines down there. Because you get high salt content, and just like with the microbes, you get too much of that in there, plants don't like it either. So one of the things that you'll see is that it's a way to leave places desolate. And a number of examples of this in the Word about places being described as desolate because of salt, like in the warnings and curses that you get at the end of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 29:23, it talks about, well, if you decide, Israel, that you're going to go off in a different direction, well, your land is going to become like the land of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's going to be like brimstone and salt. So say, okay, a place where instead of flowing with milk and honey, it's going to be, you can't grow anything there. It's going to be a desolate wasteland. Yeah, you could say with cases of blood pressure that it can also create a source of desolation, and people keep going back and forth as to whether that is the case or not. One of the things we'll see is kind of an interesting example of this is in Judges chapter 9, verse 45. And if you're curious and going on more about this, Daniel went on at length. So if you just go on to the website, you know, hallel.info, and look up Judges chapter 9, you'll see all about the great family of, you know, Gideon and Abimelech, his son, and how things can go south in a family that tends to be going, you could say, in a good direction to begin with. But one of the cases where it talks about this dispute there with Shechem and their ideas of retribution and how it boomeranged on them. And one of the cases there is Abimelech attacked Shechem and as a result and wiped out a bunch of people and also sowed the place around with salt. So that did not go well with the family involved. But another interesting case also in 2 Kings chapter 2 with Elisha is a case you might recall of where he goes and to Jericho or Jericho, and one of the things he does is he has this salt water mixture, and it's part of a ceremony that he goes through, talking about, you know, it looks like he's reversing the curse that was put on Jericho back in the early part of Judges. So that's kind of an interesting reversal, where you have the beginning part of where Jericho was left to be desolate, and then you have salt water being there to bring it back around. Now, one of these things you could say with a lot of these cases and examples of salt and a place being a wasteland because nothing grows is all these cases refer to a huge change in the situation. It is a reversal of the situation. You've taken a land that's fertile and you've destroyed it because there's all this salt there. So in the case of this with Jericho, it's a symbol of its reversal as well. It was a place that was going to be desolate, and you had this salt, maybe say a salt offering or a salt ceremony, to be a little bit of a change. But also that kind of gets at the next point, and where Yeshua really taught about salt and used it in parables, was in the case of salt being used to purify, which may be what is getting at here with the covenant of salt and why the mincha or the grain offering is offered with salt. You see some examples of the parables that Yeshua using salt. And first he likens it to the light of the world, and then he also likens it to purification. The first stop, and we'll take a look at, of one of these parables is in Matthew chapter 5. So talking about Matthew chapter 5 in the context of it's called the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 5, verse 13, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how then can be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men." So it kind of gives you this picture. Well, okay, is it referring to salt as when you get your salt shaker out? Ooh, you know, needs to add some more salt into your food to make it tasty again. Salt helps bring out flavor, except when you dump a whole lot on there and then it can start burning your mouth. Yeah, we have a comment down here.
Sometimes they use that salt and they cast it out when it didn't have its flavor. They cast it out. I forget if it's on marble or some kind of surface where they've walked on and it helped do something. I forget what it was. I'm trying to find that out.
Oh, that's interesting. I know, and you know, when I was growing up, you know, in snowy areas, salt is really nice because it can help to take down the ice on your sidewalks and such. Until it freezes again. But then, you know, the also part is when you start splashing all this salt water up on your car, and then it starts rusting everything through. But then that could be a bad thing. Yes.
It just sounds like there's so many parallels between salt and the Spirit, and what type of Spirit. There's obviously at least two different types.
Yeah, exactly.
Of what Spirit are you? What kind of salt are you? Etc.
Yeah, and you see a good key part of where the salt and the work of the Spirit comes in terms of purifying, with the parallel passage in Mark chapter 9, which is, we just read this part here about salt losing its savor. Well, Mark chapter 9 has a parallel version, and it kind of zeroes in a little bit closer as to where Yeshua was kind of getting at with this. Is this just talking about, you know, flavoring your food, making it more tasty? Mark chapter 9, verses 49 and 50. "For everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but if the salt becomes unsalty, with what will you make it salty again? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another." Okay, so does that sound like tastiness? Well, I guess you might say that you become tastier, but it's not just about flavoring of food. One of those first ones that talks about salted with fire. Oh, what do you think that's referring to? Salted with fire, the trials, the things that you go through that do what? Purify you, you know, take the parts out. You know, we always say you go through a difficulty and it'll show you what your real character is like. So in that sense that you go through fire, you go through difficulty, you go through, you know, persecution, you go through a testing part, a one discipline that is drawing out of you, is purifying you and making you better. The other part where it talks about have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. Well, what's that getting at? So you're talking about with a sense of a trial, a testing, have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. So if you're at peace with one another, what do you not have with one another? Peace and what's the opposite of peace? Strife, malice, wickedness, hatred, you know, on and on and on and on and on. So have salt in yourselves, you could say. I always like to think of this as like, you know, the koshering thing. You know, you slap on the salt and whatever, it's sucking out all of the stuff, in the case with blood or whatever you want to get out of a wound. If you're talking about its antiseptic qualities, you're getting rid of the things that could cause a lot of grief in your body. You're taking care of those things and neutralizing them or taking them out. Yes?
Absolutely necessary for our survival,
yes,
in small portions.
In small portions.
In large portions, it's absolutely poisonous.
Yes.
And salt is made up of two poisons, chlorine and sodium, both of which are poisonous by themselves. Combine them together, and you get something that's absolutely essential for us in small quantities. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think it's, when you talk about parables, I think, you know, chemistry is one of those unbelievable parables, and you just, I marvel at it all the time when you talk about those compounds where things that by themselves are deadly, but when you put them together in the right, you know, moderate amounts, then they become absolutely essential. That's a very good, there's actually a parable like that we'll be getting to in a and I think exactly when we'll be getting to that one, where it talks about the two types of, you know, talks about the two types of garments. I think we actually got to that just in recently in Exodus, but we'll be getting to that again, talking about two types of garments, and then talking about two types of seed that you sow into a field and such. Those are both getting at the similar teaching. Or you know, talk about unequally yoked, you know, putting a bull together with a donkey or something like that. All teaching very similar things in that if you do not have the right things matched together, it could be something that works against you. So just be very, very careful about the things that you decide to hook together. Which is some things I learned in chemistry. I nearly created a hazmat situation in my high school because of my lack of care in working with very, very strong acids. But that's another story. One of the things that we get at also is Paul talked about salt in Colossians chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. And he uses salt very similarly to what we just saw here in Mark. It says, conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. So just like with what Yeshua was talking about with have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. You know, Paul is similar. He uses that same language of just like you have a mincha offering and make sure you put salt on it. So too, that with the way you talk with people, especially with outside people, be careful about how you talk, because in another place Paul talks about us being ambassadors. Talking in Exodus 19 and also in Peter's writings where he mentions us as being the priesthood, about the people of God being the priesthood of God. Because You know, there is the building of the tabernacle, but there is also the building in ourselves. We got to this in a similar period when we were talking about the ourselves as being a walking, talking, living, breathing tabernacle. Paul talks about us as being the temples of the Holy Spirit. And we mentioned before about how we get in through the door, move through. It's about Messiah, and it's about the Spirit of God moving into the Father's presence. That is huge in this transformation that we have. It's all a part of what this lesson is about. If we miss the parable and fixate upon the details of the parable, we may miss the whole thing or become bored thinking that this parable has nothing left to teach us, nothing left to teach us at all. Because one of the things that you'll get through in, as we look through Hebrews, interestingly enough, if you continue on with chapter 10 of Hebrews, it mentions that, okay, it goes through the Day of Atonement and that you have this ultimate sacrifice. Because remember, we were looking through Leviticus, the first few chapters, and that's all about unintentional sins. Unintentional, unintentional, unintentional. The Day of Atonement is where you take care of the intentional stuff, the ultimate of it. Because otherwise, you are toast with most of the stuff that goes on out here day by day, that all the priesthood take care of. You are absolutely toast because that's all about unintentional stuff. The Day of Atonement takes care of the intentional and brings the congregation into the presence of God, totally cleaned, totally covered of sins, transgressions, and iniquities. The unintentional, the intentional stuff. We move from being, you could say, nearly treasonous to even being into forms of treason to being washed clean. Even though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. Even though we are scarlet with the things that bring us in opposition to God, we move through by the Spirit of God and the Son of God into His presence, as Paul calls it in Romans chapter 12, we are living sacrifice that goes in. And it talks about in chapter 12 about your behavior. It's what it's been about from the very beginning, that our behavior, who we are, has to change. Just like you change from yourself as you walk in the door, you change into the korban. You change into, you are carried like the korban in. And as we see further, these korbanot all point to the Messiah. So when it talks about in Hebrews that we go through the veil between the holy place and the most holy place through the blood of Yeshua, we are, quote, riding, unquote, on the great korban, the sacrifice, the once-for-all sacrifice. So, will it matter if you have the temple services start up again? No. Always has been a pattern of the things that are happening in heaven. They never took the place of the things happening in heaven, but it was all about what heaven was trying to do about our hearts and to change us, to change us from the inside out. So that our guts, our fat, and the entrails of us are washed clean and taken in. That all of who we were before goes up in smoke. And in the process, that what you would think would be quite disgusting, what God's reaction is that when that's burned up, it's a soothing aroma to the Lord. That is burned up and gone. Even though that in the process, you're talking about the Son of God as the korban. You would say that would be a travesty, a terrible disaster. But But it's also what takes us into the presence of God. We don't go in there because of how wonderful we are, but how gracious God is and long-suffering God is throughout all this. Well, that's kind of the preview. As we mentioned, we're going to get this again in the next parasha from the priest's perspective. But one of the things that it's always good when we start out with is like, why would you want to teach all this stuff of the Korbanot to kids? What on earth could kids ever get about this? It's the parable. To learn the parable of it. Learn the parable of transformation. Learn the parable of forgiveness. Learn the parable of atonement. That in the process, it's not just a, oh, that's interesting, but as, wow, thank you. Thank you, Father, for having mercy upon us and taking us in. Any last thoughts as we close out? Oh, yes.
I was thinking about why do all this for... Excuse me, the world likes to say it's because it was a subliterate civilization, which is really not all that true, because they had quite a bit of literacy. But it's almost like a second witness. God says, I'm here, and then we're going to play out this thing here as a second witness that this is all going on. It almost seems like that to me from after listening to you talking about it.
Well, because that's one of the key reasons why Hebrews is there. It is for people who are extremely literate in the things of God. And they can say, take a picture of, what is it that Moshe kept drumming into us? What is it that all the prophets and everybody kept drumming into this, and the crazy things that the prophets would say sometimes that seem crazy, like we saw there in Isaiah. You know, I hate your festivals and feasts. Well, didn't you tell us to do this stuff? Well, what's the problem? Ah, okay. It's what's happening in the inside that's the problem. So that when you see all the reflection throughout the book of Hebrews about all the things that go on in here and what all of this stuff was teaching there, and say, oh, this is what it all points to. So that just like when we come around every time to Yom Kippur, when we come around every time to Bikurim, and we celebrate these things and remember what it is they all point to, just like every time you hear a parable, it reminds you what the parable is about. Every time you go through all this stuff, it reminds you what's it about. So thus, when the apostles would go to the temple after the time of the crucifixion, the ascension, resurrection, did those things stop becoming parables? They move from the celestial slot machine to suddenly now something different? No. It's like, oh, I get what the parable is about. Like in the Gospels, it's like, I know about you, but every time when there's one of those where Yeshua goes aside to his disciples and explains what it is, it's like, wow, that's awesome, because you get to understand what the parable is about. Why did Yeshua say, and the prophets also pointed this out, as to why did God speak in parables? That we wanted to know what it meant, because it says you'll be ever hearing, but not understanding. You'll be ever seen, but not really actually getting things. A recruitment technique.
Come in and say, what did you mean? Say, I'll sit down and I'll tell you. That's what Christ
did. Yeah. It's a very interesting point about the recruitment technique, because one of those things that is a great hallmark of the Messiah, and you'll see it mentioned a lot of times, is people say, you spoke with great authority. And not like the other people are quoting so-and-so said so-and-so, but you are speaking with great authority. They can understand and hear, oh, the great deep things of God are coming through. When you hear in the Sermon on the Mount, oh, that's what this was all about. This is what the heart of God was really getting at. It was not like trying to look for loopholes in what the law said and such. It was like, what was the intent, the heart of God in which these things were actually said to begin with? Yes, think not that I came to destroy it, but I came to fulfill it. And that means to fill it up, to make it full. Yes. That's right. It won't be out of authority until heaven and earth pass away. I mean. Yes.
Isn't that one of those things where you go, aha, didn't it say that in the Bible somewhere? Where it says, aha.
Well, one of those things that it gets kind of looked over in Old English and whatever is it's often translated as behold. You know, one of those things it might say is you might say in more vernacular terms is like, hey, yo, hey, you, pay attention. This is something important, and you'll often see at the end of a parable, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. Another wake-up call. Hey, there's something really deep here. Check it out. There's something that you really need to know. So when we go through these things of the Korbanot and the tabernacle, we should be looking to see, what is it that is actually being taught here? What is the punchline of all this? Well, let's close in prayer here. Father God, we thank you for showing us with all these examples what your heart is. And Father, we thank you for having mercy on us, wanting to take us into your presence, not leaving us as we are here, but transforming us. We thank you for changing us from the people that we were before and turning us into people who are washed clean, made pure, and into your presence to guide us in walking further on your paths. Father, we thank you for the mercy that you show us through your Son Yeshua, through your Spirit, how you guide us, transform us. Father, we thank you for these things, and we ask for your help and your guidance, your power, to take the good news of the kingdom of God into the world. We thank you for these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.